Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the public debate on is globalization inevitable and desirable. This is a debate intended to improve understanding. There will not be a vote at the end, but you will all go away with your understanding improved. The rules of the game are that each speaker will speak for 8 minutes. We will then have an open debate for half to three quarters of an hour, and I will then ask each of the speakers to sum up in 2 minutes. This debate has been organized by three institutions devoted to the cause of rational debate: the Financial Times, Le Monde Diplomatique, and the European Institute of LSE. I think probably most of the audience know particularly well two of those institutions, and many of us, despite the fact that the English edition is not yet published, are devoted readers of Le Monde Diplomatique in its many language editions. But I think, therefore, it's appropriate to give an advantage to the visitors and ask Bernard Casson to say a few words of introduction.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, colleagues of the FT, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of my two colleagues, Serge Halimi and Riccardo Petrella, and of the whole editorial staff of Le Monde Diplomatique, let me first express my thanks to the LSE, and especially to Dr. Howard Machin, Director of the European Institute, for organizing this public debate on the merits and demerits of globalization. This is undoubtedly a rather unusual event. Not that globalization be in any measure a non-controversial phenomenon all over the world, including the US, Britain, and the rest of Europe, there is no lack of dissenting voices to the media-engineered alleged inevitability and desirability of global markets and of all that goes with them. Yet, these voices very seldom find public space and public channels to make themselves heard, which, by the way, speaks volumes about the way citizens and voters are presented with the contradictory facts and analysis that might enable them to form their own opinion. This is why we welcome this opportunity to address this learned audience of students, academics, and other people, some of them coming from other parts of Britain and even from the continent, who are with us this afternoon. One point should be clear from the start. This is not a contest between British and French journalists. This is not a return game of the recent Twickenham victory of the French rugby team in the Five Nations tournament. To make that point even clearer, we decided that Le Monde Diplomatique Party should include a non-French member. This is why we asked our Brussels-based colleague and friend and president of our Readers Association, Riccardo Petrella, an Italian married to a Belgian, to join us, that is a European, to join us in London. We like to define Le Monde Diplomatique not as a French paper, but as an international paper based in Paris, and I gathered this afternoon that the Financial Times also defines itself as an international paper based in London. That is, in our case, with contributors coming from all parts of the world, and many of them also regular readers of the Financial Times. If anything, Le Monde Diplomatique is a European and Mediterranean paper with separate editions in Arabic, German, Italian, and Spanish. That is, with a total circulation of about 500,000. One of our other publications, Manière de Voir, has a Greek edition. When we have an English edition, which should happen in the not-too-distant future, I hope, we might even claim that we are going global. But as you've guessed, this word, as they say in diplomatic circles, is persona non grata in our private lexicon. And we prefer to stick to international as an identifying adjective. Well, if this is not a cross-channel contest, what is it then? At the risk of confirming that there really is a Gallic idiosyncrasy, which consists in putting theory and politics into everything, I will say this is a contest between two different views of the role of the economy in human affairs. In other words, a contest between two conflicting views of the world. I shall, of course, leave it to our colleagues of the FT to elaborate their own vision. But in order to show where the dividing line is, in my view, I shall quote from the editorial column which they published on the eve of the British general election, that is, last week, on April the 29th. The conclusion read like this. The opinions of the FT are shaped by a belief in the market economy, free trade, and the creation of an outward-looking Europe. I think that the phrase outward-looking Europe can have very different meanings, some of which we might agree with. Yet, if I had to define in broad terms what the opinions of Le Monde Diplomatique are, I would say that they are shaped by a belief that the market economy must be strictly disciplined and regulated to serve the needs of the whole of mankind and not simply corporate greed. That the highest good in life is certainly not to shop, and hence that free trade must yield precedence to more elevated values such as the enforcement of human labor and environment rights. This emphasis on non-economic values puts us at odds with the tenets of the so-called global economy. Competitiveness as the cornerstone of economic achievement and unrestricted flow of capital and goods. Our common belief is that the rush towards globalization has not delivered the goods, the promised goods, and that it exacts a devastating price on both developed and third world countries. We also believe that it is not too late to stop further disaster from happening, and that this can be done by exploring alternative paths. It is a near impossible endeavor to detail these points in the very limited amount of time available this afternoon, so we shall concentrate on three of them, alternating with the expositions of our FT colleagues. First, Riccardo Petrella will focus on the self-destructive effects of unbridled competition, which brings to my mind the very apt comparison James Goldsmith once made when he wrote in his in a recent book that in the medium term the winning firms in the global village will be like the winners of a poker game on the Titanic. I shall then try to expose the ruinous results of free trade, a 19th century ideology that in my view has outlived the historical circumstances and conditions of its relevance. Lastly, Serge Halimi will explain that in the media, the ideological package of globalization has generally been presented by its main advocates and beneficiaries, while its critics and victims have largely been ignored. And he will suggest a promising new area for media studies, what he calls the emergence of market journalism. This is all for the moment. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Professor Petrella, I invite you as a true European to open the debate.
Yes, good afternoon to everybody. I would like to submit a motion this afternoon to you. The one part of this motion is to stand in favor of sustainable forms of global coexistence, co-development, and cooperative systems of governance. And the second element of the motion is to stand against today's competitive, deregulated, liberalized, privatized, short-term financial gains-driven warfare market globalization. I am, as a matter of fact, I think that we must all be for a global stable monetary system. For instance, developing a financial security council at a global level. We should be for a set of global networks for basic public interest telecom, transport, education, health, infrastructures and services. I think that all we should share the fact that we should operate, act for a world ecological sustainability, like now the Concerned parties have created a forestry stewardship council at the global level, including forestry producers, for nuclear safety, fight against the criminal economy, like drug, tax evasions throughout the world. And we should stand for global dialogue of cultures, and particularly the role of media should be in favor of such a dialogue culture. I think that we have to fight immediately against an abuse. And the abuse is the mystification to consider that the currently prevailing form of economic globalization is the only possible form of globalization. That's it, false. This is an ideological trap. It's an ideological trap to say either you are for globalization or you are against globalization. This is an expression of profound scientific and political cultural misery. And as a matter of fact, it's not true that no one country can stop globalization or evade. Not even America, as the Herald Tribune International said a few months ago. And also it's not true that as Mr. Harahap, an Indonesian minister, said no one can avoid the process of globalization. And when it comes to attracting investment for infrastructure, an Indonesian minister said, then it's like a war, kill or be killed. And I think that we can stand against, and we have to stand against this kind of a globalization, and we can evade it. We can transform it. But let me give seven reasons, very specific, for standing against, again, liberalized, deregulated, competitive, market capitalist globalization. Reason one, I will use in short LDCMG to stand for liberalization, deregulated, competitive, market capitalist globalization. So, LDCMG, reason one, does not make possible the most efficient allocation of material and material resources of the planet at local, national, global level. Let me just refer to present overcapacities. Automobile industry is overcapacity. Chemicals, pharmaceuticals, electronics, textile, steel. They are everywhere overcapacities, and this is why in the next 10 years they will cut, they will eliminate jobs, they will reduce unemployment. And in other areas we have shortages. Second, productivity decreases are characterized now the production of the three basic cereals. Structurally speaking, our world, globalized, liberalized, deregulated, competitive agriculture, is diminishing the return in productivity. Energy misuses. The way we define productivity in a monodimensional paradigmatic term, it means that it's only financial monetary measure. And a school that is not financially profitable can be closed because then it's not productive. What a misery in defining a school in these terms. Reason two, LDCMG penalizes industry-oriented wealth creation in favor of finance-oriented gains production. And this is why we have today a growing pressure from maximization of short-term returns to shareholders. And we are witnessing the increasing dissociation between real economy and financial growth. The spirit of finance is fighting against the spirit of enterprises. In a globalized, regulated, liberalized, competitive market, the only legal public accountability of a corporate management in the use of their power is not to local prosperity, jobs, and a clean environment for all, but to a global financial market that has only one insensate demand: maximize short-term returns to shareholders. And this is why all the system is passing the cost of production onto community. Declining wages, declining working conditions, declining tax, getting more subsidies from government, and with the normal system of privatizing the gains to the benefit of the power holders. And reason three, LDCMG has an unjustified bias in favor of large multinational enterprises to the detriment of small and medium enterprises. And I just want to refer to the impacts due to the global outsourcing, to the flexible specialization system, to the global switching production system, which leads to the massive exploitation of subcontracting the small and medium enterprise army. And even the worst now, the situation where the subcontracted of subcontracted firms are submitted to a stress, to a strain which develop particularly under bad conditions. Reason four, LDCMG wastefully reduces the life cycle of processes, products and services. Fast growing economic obsolescence and cost to keep pace with change, waste management and recycling. And increasing economic and social volatility, short-term uncertainties, fast and short-term amortization in electronics, information industry, R&D activities, everything is becoming fast obsolete. Reason five, LDCMG is weakening the competitive nature of markets. Contrary to the rhetoric of free market ideology, in a globalized regulated market, successful competitors can even greater monopolistic advantages through their accumulation of economic and political power. Reason six, I have another one. LDCMC is given the power of setting the agenda to financial institutions, depossessing elected representative assemblies. Competitive global market economy is highly responsive only to the wants of those who have money. And reason seven, LDCMG makes losers in the present economy far outnumbering the winners, not only in Indonesia and in Egypt, but also in the USA, in Germany. The losers are middle class, those who are aged more than 50 years, immigrant and skilled female workers, young people. And who is speaking for the losers? FT?
Guy de Jonquière, the World Trade and Business Editor of the Financial Times, is certainly speaking.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm not going to attempt at this stage to respond to Mr. Petrelli's long list of objections to globalization, but I think it might help to just start by defining what we're actually talking about. And I think I can hardly do better than quote the description given in the IMF's latest World Economic Outlook. Quote, "The growing economic interdependence of countries worldwide through the increasing volume and variety of cross-border transactions in goods and services and of international capital flows, and also through the more rapid and widespread diffusion of technology." Now, the next question is, why has this process occurred? It is undoubtedly closely related to changes in technology, particularly in communications and computers. But I think that much more important than that, it's happened because governments around the world have chosen consciously and deliberately to make it happen by removing barriers around their markets which have impeded trade and international investment. That's sometimes been done collectively, notably in the GATT and the WTO trade agreements, but much more often unilaterally and individually. Everywhere one looks, the most important progress has been made by countries acting alone. So I don't think that there is necessarily any intrinsic inevitability to globalization. Governments can accept it, and they can also reject it. And some have done just that by continuing to insulate their economies from global markets and international competition. But just look at the countries which have pursued that logic most tenaciously. Among the most obvious examples are Burma, Cuba, North Korea, Iran, Iraq, and Libya. And just look at the results. industrial backwardness, penury, and even, in North Korea's case, probably mass famine. It's also, I think, wrong to suggest that these policies were, in any democratic sense of the word, the result of free choice. The markets were kept closed by repressive regimes which imposed their will without any attempt to consult the people that they were governing. All the evidence suggests to me that when people are offered a free choice between closed, highly regulated economies and open markets, they've tended to reject the former in favour of the latter. There could scarcely be a clearer example than the fate of Comecon, the managed trade system practiced by the Soviet Union and its East European satellites until the late 1980s. Never in history has a grander experiment been devised to test the proposition that markets didn't work and that comparative advantage was nonsense. But who today would defend that system as a superior economic model? Certainly not the citizens of the former Soviet Union or Central Europe, who suffered the deprivation for which it was responsible. Despite the undoubtedly painful transition which they now face in adjusting to market economy principles, who anywhere is calling for the return of Comecon? Similarly, where in Latin America is there any nostalgia for the autarkic protectionist regimes practiced widely in the 1960s and 70s? And I'd remind Mr. Petrelli, as I listened to his list of complaints, how much they reminded me of all the reasons that were given at that time by countries like Brazil as to why internationalization was a bad thing and it was essential to find a middle way. There's a really striking and remarkable parallel. But since those countries have acquired the right to choose their governments, their people in countries like Argentina, Chile and Brazil have cast their votes for governments committed to achieving growth through liberalisation and market-based reforms. True, the pursuit of these objectives also encounters popular resistance. There are clearly signs of liberalisation fatigue in several parts of the world. In South America, there is obvious disappointment that faster growth has failed to reduce poverty and raise living standards as quickly as many had hoped, while Mexico's recent crisis has also been seen by some as a warning of the dangers of global markets. But what these experiences, I think, actually suggest is that reforms have not yet gone far enough. Eradication of poverty and disease requires more effective social policies aimed notably at improving education and health systems. The chief lesson of Mexico's debacle, meanwhile, is that market reforms cannot work when a government engages in recklessly irresponsible financial practices. Also, while there may be hesitations about how fast liberalisation should move ahead, there is no evidence of any grassroots pressure to turn the clock back. The humiliating defeat of Pat Buchanan's US presidential campaign last year is proof that even voters who fear the consequences of globalisation see no real practical alternative to it. Furthermore, there is much compelling evidence that harnessing one's economy to the global market works. The most dramatic and most widely publicised is the astonishing increase in real incomes which the tiger economies of East Asia have achieved in less than 30 years by pursuing export-led growth. In Latin America, Chile's success remains a beacon and a model to which others in the region aspire. Even in Africa, which was once written off as an economic basket case, there are signs of hope. Countries such as Ghana and Uganda, which have begun to dismantle huge barriers to trade and investment while adopting market-based domestic reforms, are being rewarded by substantially higher growth rates. The first duty of any government is to raise the standard of living of its people. And the growth of global markets and international competition offer more people in more countries the opportunity to pursue that objective than ever before in history. And yet, there are those in the industrialized West who object that it is all terribly unfair. Free trade, they argue, is the principal culprit for all the ills afflicting their countries, be they high unemployment, widening income differentials, or decline in manufacturing jobs. A frequent response, is to a proposal to put up the barriers. Sometimes an attempt is made to dignify this argument by cloaking it in demands for a social clause in trade agreements. The ostensible justification is that such a mechanism is required to ensure respect for core labour standards. As a goal, this is surely admirable. Who, after all, could defend the exploitation of child labour as a desirable practice? But is that what really motivates advocates of a social clause? I think, I should quote from an article by Mr. Cassin, who, when fulminating against the WTO's rejection of world trade restrictions as a means of enforcing labour standards, recently said, "Must industrialised countries, in the name of comparative advantage, abandon all their labour-intensive industries to low-wage countries?" I think that that is a huge exaggeration, and I would just quote two simple facts in support of that. First of all, if low-wage countries were really taking up such a large share of labour-intensive products, the price of labour-intensive products would have fallen. They haven't. They've risen since early 1980. And secondly, of the top 20 exporters of manufacturers who account for 90% of world exports, only two, China and Mexico, are indisputably low-wage countries, accounting for about 6% of the total. The facts simply do not support alarmist theories that ruthless low-wage competition is responsible for the problems of Western economies. In truth, these stem far less from the advent of global markets than from the West's slowness to adapt to them. It's always easier to stick one's head in the sand than to embrace the challenge of change. But mimicking the posture of the ostrich is a high-risk policy in a world inhabited by tigers and would-be tigers.
Thank you. We return to Mr. Cassin for Le Monde.
Thank you. Well, I will try to explain what are the devastating results of the free trade orthodoxy. And perhaps I shall take a slightly different line from Guy. As I said in my earlier exposition, I'm an avid daily reader of the Financial Times. I highly value the information which it provides, even though I practically never agree with its editorial comments. Yet, there are exceptions to that rule. I hope I will not do your colleague John Rogley a disservice if I say that he expressed in a nutshell what it will take some more time for me to make plain when he wrote last March that, quote, "free trade is fine if you ignore the paupers." He was referring to the plight of West Indian banana producers should they no longer receive preferential tariff treatment from their former colonial masters of the EU. Since he wrote that, a WTO panel has ruled that the American multinationals who exploit Central American banana groves must be given the same preferential treatment as the West Indian producers. A situation, Rogley wrote, which might drive the islanders to do something dreadful, that is, cultivating cocaine instead of bananas, knowing that they will be crunched in open competition. Will they have another option? He asked, and I ask myself as well. This is one of the many absurdities of the free trade orthodoxy, one that paradoxically commands maximum consensus among economists and politicians, as well as in most of the media. Indeed, especially since the Uruguay round of the GATT and the creation of the World Trade Organization 2 years ago, we have been brainwashed to believe that deregulated trade and open markets would inevitably produce higher international living standards and a more just society for all. While the actual results are quite different, I will sum them up in four statements to be briefly substantiated later. First, free trade has dramatically increased inequalities between and within nations and is putting a premium on the disregard of labor and human rights. Second, in most cases, free trade is destroying jobs and driving down wages. Third, free trade is methodically ruining the environment in the South and to a lesser extent in the North. Fourth, free trade creates a culture of insecurity, unravels the fabric of societies and communities, and undermines the faith in democratic institutions where they exist. First, free trade and inequalities. Well, a recent series of articles in the Washington Post confirmed UN statistics by on-the-spot reporting in China, Africa, and Mexico. What these statistics show is that while export-oriented economies in Asia have undoubtedly, I grant you that, Guy, have undoubtedly created millions of jobs, they have very often done so in sweatshop conditions. Investors in labor-intensive industries relish sweatshop, children labor, no union, and no strike situations. This is why they invest massively in China. There is no correlation between investment and need. While Africa desperately needs investment in infrastructures, education, and health, foreign investment dropped by 27% in 1995 to a mere $2.1 billion, that is 3% of FDI flowing into developing countries. Because of structural adjustment policies, which are the other side of the free trade coin, the percentage of poor people has regularly grown and not decreased in the Black Continent, in Latin America, and particularly in the two countries which were quoted before me, Argentina and Brazil, and the Caribbean since the early 90s. The so-called boon of globalization has bypassed them. As to developed countries, and among them the champions of free trade, the US and the UK, figures are in everybody's minds, which show that the rich are getting richer and the ever-growing mass of the poor getting poorer. Now, free trade, wages and jobs. Just a few figures. Between 1973 and 1993, the real hourly wage of U.S. citizens without a high school diploma fell by one-third in 20 years, from $11.85 to $8.64. So much so that sociologists have had to invent a new category, the so-called working poor. Poorer workers are getting even poorer, losing wages, social benefits, and very often their jobs. As to Britain, you know better than I why the voters rejected the Tories en masse, as you say in English, although I am far from being convinced that the poor and the unemployed would be really better off under Mr. Tony Blair. In Germany, where the number of jobless nearly reaches the unprecedented 5 million level, industrialists are preparing to create tens of thousands of jobs, but not in Germany, outside Germany. On many occasions, they have bluntly stated that the German worker is a far too expensive commodity in a free trade economy. Now, the environment. You cannot green free trade because it encourages industries to shift their production activities where environment standards considered as a comparative advantage or disadvantage are the lowest possible. I'll skip some points. Now, democracy, which is a central point. The urge to export, which is the first commandment of free trade, leads to situations in which people are encouraged to produce what they do not consume and consume what they do not produce. A special separation is thus created between the people who suffer the costs and those people and corporations that enjoy the benefits. So that there is a situation in which the broader the free trade area, the less answerable the footloose corporation will be to any national, not to mention local community. Answerability is the touchstone of democracy. When elected governments are unable to give any guarantee to their fellow citizens as to their well-being, when the real decision-making people and firms are beyond their reach, when nobody appears to be in charge, what is the point of voting then? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Peter Martin, the FT's... it's Martin Wolf next, who's the associate editor of the FT.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you would guess by now that it would be really truly impossible to deal with every point raised, so perhaps I'm told that we'll have 2 minutes at the end to come back, and some of them I hope I will be able to return to then. I'd like to start, as since this debate has come, as I expected it would, to be largely a debate about trade and protection, with one of my favourite pieces, in fact, I think the best single piece ever written on free trade and protection. And it starts as follows. From the manufacturers of candles, tapers, lanterns, candlesticks, street lamps, snuffers and extinguishers, and from the producers of tallow, oil, resin, alcohol, and generally of everything connected with lighting, to the honourable members of the Chambers of Deputies, we are suffering from the ruinous competition of a foreign rival who apparently works under conditions so far superior to our own for the production of light that he is flooding the domestic market with it at an incredibly low price. This rival, which is none other than the sun, is waging war on us so mercilessly that we suspect he is being stirred up against us by perfidious Albion, particularly because he has for that haughty island a respect he does not show for us. We ask you to be so good as to pass a law requiring the closing of all windows, dormers, skylights, inside and outside, shutters, curtains, casements, bullseyes, deadlights and blinds, in short, all openings, holes, chinks and fissures through which the light of the sun is wont to enter houses, to the detriment of the fair industries with which we are proud to say we have endowed the country. And this famous piece of prose was written, of course, by the greatest of all French commentators on trade, Frédéric Bastiat. And I think what we have heard so far seems to me to fit very beautifully into his paradigm. Because what we have heard is, in essence, that we are being subject, all of us, everywhere, wherever we are, to absolutely ruinous, unfair competition by definition, and it must be stopped. It must be regulated. It must be controlled by beneficent government. From Mr. Petrella, we had arguments which I remember very well, every one of them, the arguments for the overwhelming superiority of a properly planned economy of the Soviet type. Exactly. The whole lot. Every one of them. And we had it. And we had the experience, as my colleague pointed out. Essentially, we talked about uncoordinated markets, excess production, excess consumption, the whole range of problems which were in an eradicable in a market economy and had to be eliminated. Let me make, if I may, two fundamental points and then deal with one very significant issue without, at this stage, going enormously far into all the details that have been presented. First of all, if you believe that market exchange is valuable, that it is, in fact, desirable for human beings to specialize, and that of all the systems the world has tried, and it has tried many, the market economy has been proved to be the least unsuccessful, then it must logically follow that the greatest opportunities for all of us will exist at the global level. There must be more opportunities to exploit more resources, skills, and talents if we all can trade with one another than if we are limited or circumscribed by the borders of a particular nation. Second, that is indeed exactly what the experience of the last half century of progressive liberalization has showed. Countries in the developing world who have shifted towards more liberalization have not on the whole done so because they were forced to do so. They have done so because many of them, indeed most of them, tried all the rational import substitution, closed to anti-trade, anti-internationalization policies that our opponents would recommend. They tried and they failed. China did not abandon Maoism because it loves capitalism. It abandoned it because it didn't work and because the people of China suffered vastly greater losses of income and of lives under the system that existed when China was not integrated into the world economy than at present. And that follows to the second fundamental point I wanted to make. Even now, no country is forced to open its borders. If any country truly feels by democratic choice that its citizens would be better off if they traded only with one another, and forwent altogether the opportunities provided by trade and capital flows, since you can hardly expect people to invest in you if you're not able to repay them through trade, they are free to do so. But of course they have not, and they have not done so for very good reason. Now let me deal with what seems to me the real practical drive underlying this question, rather than the cloudy metaphysics of it all. What about the workers? The workers here and the workers in developing countries. Contrary to what has been argued on the basis of purely circumstantial evidence, a vast amount of sophisticated economic analysis has been done, both here and even more in the United States, of the effect of trade and other changes on wages and employment. Many of the most distinguished scholars would argue that there is no discernible effect of trade on wages or indeed employment. And they argue so because if there is such an effect, it ought to have worked, in theory, through a fundamental shift in the terms of trade, a decline in the prices of the imports of labor-intensive manufactures into our countries. There has been no such observed change. Some other scholars, admittedly, look at this slightly differently. And there are a number who think that possibly some 10 to 20% of the relative decline in wages is due to imports, but certainly no more. So what has been the dominant factor? Why has this happened? And the answer to that seems pretty clear. It is the consequence of two things. One, consistent failures of macroeconomic policy, particularly in Europe, particularly in allowing stagnation because of poor monetary policies, and secondly, more important still, because of the nature of technological change over the last 20 or 30 years. So if you wish to stop this, we must stop technology. That's what we must stop. In fact, we must go back, and I think some of our opponents would like to go back to essentially a Luddite position on the economic system. The second point I wanted to make, because this covers our situation, is the situation of workers in developing countries. We know, there is really no mystery about this, that there is a very, very close link between trade policy, export growth, and economic growth. We also know that over lengthy periods, rapid economic growth tends, but doesn't necessarily, I admit, to lead to large increase in real incomes and real wages for the people in the countries affected. But if you're dealing with a country like China, with hundreds of millions of desperately poor people, vastly worse off where they are, vastly worse off than they are, than where they will be and are when they move to produce for export, of course, it will take many, many years for the employment growth, before the employment growth and the industrialization starts generating really rapid rises in real wages and real incomes. In every country that has gone through the industrialization process, including our own, it did take a while before real wages rose. But if you look at Japan, you look at Korea, you look at Singapore, you look at Hong Kong, you look even at ourselves, there is no question that if the sort of growth that countries like China have experienced in the last 10 years is sustained for another 20 or 30, and there is no reason why it shouldn't, on the basis of policies of international engagement, the real incomes of everybody, or virtually everybody in these countries, will rise. And this is the best news for the entire world, I think, that you could possibly offer.
Closing for Le Monde is Professor Serge Halimi.
What should we journalists, intellectuals, do in a global world in which 358 billionaires have more assets than the combined incomes of nearly half of the planet's population? What should we do where According to the UN Development Programme Administrator, I quote, if present trends continue, economic disparities between industrial and developing nations will move from inequitable to inhuman. What should we do when, within democratic countries themselves, money dominates the political system until it has become the system? Those who write the checks write the laws and ask the questions. Increasingly, citizens seem to be replaced with investors. And now, what can we, as journalists, do to denounce this situation and suggest remedies? When so many of these billionaires, the Rupert Murdochs, the Ted Turners of the world, own the papers for which we write, the radios on which we speak, the television networks for which we appear. When so much of the news and the culture that is fed into developing nations comes from industrial countries, and so little of the news that industrial countries receive seeps in from developing nations. When those who write the checks and write the laws and ask the questions and invest and divest and downsize are also our employers, our providers of advertising revenue, our trendsetters, our decision takers, our newsmakers. In other words, can we even think of doing what we must in this global world, what we should as journalists and as intellectuals, comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable, fulfilling our mission as a counterpower, as a voice for the voiceless, when so many of us are as much a part of the ruling class as the business elite itself? When so many of us echo the interest of the powerful and blame the attitudes of the poor? This, too, is the result of the type of globalization we have let happen. And although I do not believe this globalization to be inevitable, I think that the mass media are indeed trying to make it seem inevitable and to pretend it is desirable. And no one, least of all us journalists and intellectuals, should deny the power of the ideas which we disseminate to the drumbeat of around-the-clock propaganda. 2.5 years ago, at Le Monde Diplomatique, we called this propaganda pensée unique. The expression caught so fast that within a month, Jacques Chirac used it to jumpstart his sputtering presidential campaign, and 3 months later, he had become president of France. Needless to say, our ideas are not in power in Paris. The sense of the expression has lost a lot with its popularity, and Jacques Chirac is not a disciple any one of us at Le Monde Diplomatique wishes to have. So what is pensée unique, or more precisely, what was it before its meaning became blurred? And why should we oppose it? The answer, it is the ideological translation of the interest of global capital, of the priorities of financial markets, and of those who invest in them. It is the dissemination in leading newspapers of the policies advocated by the international economic institutions, which use and abuse the credit, data, and expertise they are entrusted with, such international economic institutions as the World Bank, the IMF, the OECD, the World Trade Organization. In constant expansion, because of globalization, this new orthodoxy results in submitting democratically elected governments to the one and only policy claimed to be sustainable by the so-called experts, that policy which has the consent of the rich. Should we accept this, our politics will amount, and it largely does, to little more than a pseudo-debate between parties of government shouting the minuscule differences which separate them and hiding the significant convergences which unite them. Electoral dissatisfaction is already the result of this non-debate. In the United States, where foreign companies invested heavily now in the now infamous White House coffees, funding Bill Clinton's re-election, thereby blurring the line between national politics and global commerce, only 48.8% of the eligible voters went to the polls last November, the lowest turnout since 1924. This indifference or disaffection almost amounted to a quiet act of civil disobedience. But I'd like to take another example, this one from Greece, and see how the mainstream press, in this instance the Washington Post, reacted to this pensée, to the election, by accepting the major postulates of what we at Le Monde Diplomatique also like to call market journalism. Last December, Greek peasants were barring the roads to protest austerity measures threatening their survival. One of them complained, I quote, "The only right we have is the right to vote, and it leads us nowhere." There, too, an election had been held, leading to the victory of a pro-business socialist party. And when it happened, the Washington Post had concluded, I quote, "This was the first truly modern election in the history of the birthplace of democracy. The two parties essentially agree on most of the major issues." Can we, as journalists and intellectuals, accept the idea that a modern democracy is one where the major parties agree on most issues? And if we do, as is the case too often, how dare we bemoan the rise of so-called extremism and populism when it is but the mere consequence of legitimate anger stemming from a truncated political debate in a socially polarized society? We all make fun of the tendency, especially in America, to be politically correct. But don't we fall in the trap of being economically correct, cheerleaders for the stock market, asleep at the switch when Robert Maxwell was robbing his companies, or maybe just too busy then, writing fawning profiles of Carlos Salinas's economic miracle? Leaving aside these missteps, the definition of modernity and of its opposite is, I believe, one of the most telling instances of the weight of this economic correctness. When one listens to the mass media, modernity is almost inevitably linked with free trade, strong currencies, deregulation, privatizations, communication of those who have the means to communicate with each other in the virtual communities they create. Europe, insofar as it is the Europe of free trade, strong currency, privatizations, and communications. Outdated notions, on the other hand, are almost invariably the welfare state, government in general, unless it shrivels into a lean and mean law and order machine, unions, which are assumed to defend so-called special interests, unlike those of, say, big business, the nation state, guilty of fostering nationalism, the people, always likely to be seduced with the sirens of populism. Then let me say it, this modernity is archaic, and outdated notions have never been more necessary. So yes, indeed, we must oppose globalization and its logical consequences. But most of all, we must fight the belief that globalization is inevitable. And in this respect, Le Monde Diplomatique and the Financial Times cannot be but allies, because what at Le Monde Diplomatique could we add to the excellent analysis of Martin Wolf in an article he wrote 2 years ago and he just restated here? The article was titled "The Global Economy Myth." It said, I quote, "Global economic integration is far from irresistible. Governments have the power to lower trade barriers and eliminate foreign exchange controls. They could, if they wished, halt both processes. They must. Let us help them."
And closing for the FT, it's International Edition editor Peter Martin.
We've talked a lot so far about the economic issues involved, the pluses and, in some cases, or at least from one point of view, the minuses of globalization. But I would like to put to you the profoundly moral, ethical case for globalization. The accelerated integration of marginalized societies is the best thing that has happened in the lifetime of any of the people in this room. It is a true collaboration, internationally, across borders, across societies, across cultures, not the phony collaboration of the spurious North-South dialogues and the bureaucratic elite. Not only has it undermined the evil enemy of the Soviet Union, it is also starting to achieve the same effect in China. But even if it hadn't had these directly political effects, it would still have been an extraordinarily positive event. It has produced an enormous degree of improvement in human happiness worldwide. In those countries which have taken advantage of the opportunities which lie before them. These have been completely ignored by Le Monde Diplomatique in what they've said today. It will produce, this transformation, will produce exactly the opposite of the result Serge Halimi predicts. An irreversible shift of power away from the developed countries to the rest of the world. It is the desire to head this off, in my view, this fundamental desire to preserve the status quo, to keep the hegemony of the profoundly conservative ideology that you've heard from the other side this evening, which underlies their view of the world. It is profoundly immoral to seek to exclude third world aspirations merely to preserve the convenience of a particular pattern of Western work. Professor Petrella says that there are many more losers than winners. This is simply untrue, both in absolute terms and in relative terms, as any study of international economic statistics will show you. Bernard Casson says millions of jobs have been created in sweatshop conditions. Sweatshop conditions. Tell that to the educated workforces of Hong Kong, Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, the electronics workers at Samsung, the car makers at Daewoo, and the workers of southern China who have proceeded from agricultural misery and are making their way through sweatshop conditions, it is true, to genuine prosperity and independence of living. Serge Halimi says journalists blame the attitude of the poor. On the contrary, I exult in their aspirations, in their desires for wealth, prosperity, and freedom. It is possible to opt out of globalization, but the price that is paid is not merely the economic one described by Martin Wolf today. It is also a political one, because the desire to repress globalization leads to an inevitable extension of the powers of the state and a loss of individual freedom. It requires the suppression of natural desires of individuals, an ever more elaborate web of regulation, legislation, the criminalization of natural economic activities, the politicization of routine decisions, and we've seen that in many European countries over the past 20 to 30 years. It requires a fundamental undermining of democratic rights, including that most important, that most precious right, the desire to be left alone. You may have your own views about whether the freedom to choose between 30 different types of breakfast cereal is a valuable freedom. That is a matter of opinion. What is not a matter of opinion, but a matter of bitter experience, is that the extension of state power required to eliminate the cross-border choice offered by globalization is damaging and deeply anti-democratic. Petrella said that free trade must cede precedence to more elevated values, such as the preservation of labor and environmental standards. More elevated values. Surely there is no more elevated value than delivering billions of people from poverty, creating opportunities for choice and personal development, and reinforcing democracy all around the world. The liberal market economy is by its very nature global. It is the summit of human endeavor. We should be proud that by our work and by our votes, we have contributed to building it.
The floor is now yours. Would you give your name and, if you feel it appropriate, affiliation before you speak? And speak loudly, please. The people at the back upstairs.
When you want to go in an enormous market, and that you are a little one like that, it means that you have to ask the biggest one to come and help you with their money, which they do direct. But I always see in my life that the benefit of those big enterprises, the benefit, is always going back where the the one who put the money are living and stay in your country, what we call le petit lait. The little milk. You can't do butter with that. You can't do cheese like that. With that, you can't do nothing. It means that I would like that those gentlemen explain me. So are you good? Why, for example, the pound is no more a world money. I would like to explain to you also why now, and I will close, in the Pyrenees, some ecologists think to put some teddy bears there, and they put three of them, two female and one male. A very open market, because you can't stop those people. I would like that those gentlemen explain me what is passing now to the chiefs, to les brebis. They told me that there is less and less, and the teddy bears is going fast, more and more growth. Could you explain me the system? How is it possible? The teddy bears is a very late FNAT.
Thank you. I think we've got the sense. But I'll ask the speakers to return later. Yes, sir. Name, please.
Do you want a response from me?
You can respond at the end, or if you want to respond to a specific point, please come in either side.
I just say, I think the on Comic-Con that the gentleman is connecting two unconnected facts. Yes, there was a COCOM embargo on military technology. The Comic-Con system, however, was wholly designed by the then Soviet Union as a system that was designed totally to eliminate market and comparative advantage forces. COCOM came after that, and I think the faults of Comic-Con cannot be blamed on COCOM.
No, I thought the question was referring to the American embargo against the nations which are cut from foreign trade, and where you've said the situation was ghastly. I mean, the embargo against Cuba, like against Iran, against Iraq, I mean, those countries have not necessarily chosen to be cut away from the flows of foreign trade.
Cuba was effectively part an extension of the Comic-Con system. They did choose to be cut off.
Yep.
It's a fact. The windfall tax will be used in order to help 250,000 young jobless youth to get jobs and training. Could you kindly comment on this? Thank you. Yes.
Could you speak louder?
Louder, please.
Sorry?
Louder.
I was saying that the British side are correct to put the free trade case, so globalization is just revisiting a 150-year-old argument, that free trade does generate benefits that you wouldn't have under a protectionist.
gain under which free trade operates, there are some very severe costs. However, what we don't get from either side, and this is the thing that's missing, is a notion of how you can have the benefits of free trade while retaining the social benefits that also go with the humane total system. And it's in relation to Mr. Halimi's plaintive cry about the constraints on journalists and intellectuals. And may I offer a comment on that point? And it's particularly apposite for the French journalists and intellectuals, because actually the free trade industrial system, if it had been based correctly, as advocated by the very earliest of free trade, free market theorists, I'm referring specifically to the physiocrats from France and Adam Smith, who brought the key element from the physiocrats, we wouldn't actually be having this argument between the two sides today. Namely that it was acknowledged that free trade was the ideal arrangement, the British are correct, but what the physiocrats said was we have to preserve the social sector, and the social sector should be financed out of the net income flowing from the economy. Now, the net income generated by the global economy is huge. It's an unearned income. It is the income that is attributed to natural resources. And unfortunately, the reason why we have the confusion, the damage, environmental and social, is that the net benefits do not accrue to the community in the way that physiocrats and Adam Smith recommended. So it seems sad that the intellectuals of France are not actually developing this concept of socializing the net income arising from free trade in order to privatize the privately earned income which the British would like to maximize.
Thank you.
Globalization and liberalization.
speak up, please, and give your name and affiliation. Speak up.
We heard a lot about what civilization does and what it doesn't do, and I guess that's the subject of the debate. I'd just like to have some illustrations about what the alternative scenario would be.
Louder. Thank you.
Do you wish to come back on this? At the end.
Well, no. On the social charter, I would just say it's great news to hear that Tony Blair has decided to sign it for Great Britain. Now we just have to make the social charter meaningful.
Okay.
Thank you. Yes. We've just time for just a few more contributions, and then I'll ask the speakers to reply in the order they prefer. They can be thinking about that. Sorry, yes.
Money.
without being enslaved by the fact that we are all submitted to this blindness, not seeing how we are being deprived of our rights.
Thank you. We have time for one more question, I think. Sir.
Hasn't the Financial Times team entirely neglected the finite nature of the world's resources? They've talked about the rate of growth in China. Well, reading a recent study about development in China, two of the facts that stand out prominently are the fact that China roughly has the same area as the United States, but about three times its population. The pressure on land in China, with a great deal of desert, of course, in China, is tremendous and growing. The population is rising, and expanding industrial areas affect very valuable agricultural land. This is resulting in a land crisis and a water crisis. There is a real water crisis in China now, and one must expect that this is going to be greatly exacerbated. Now, China is already attending, there are a lot of studies inside China on this, as I understand it. But there is a real problem that if anything like the colossal rate of growth that's going on in China at the present time were to be continued, as the Financial Times team has suggested it might, to the betterment of their people, it will result in a chronic environmental crisis. This fact hasn't seemed to be mentioned at all.
Thank you very much. We're now going to ask any of the original speakers if they wish to reply quickly on any matter of fact, and then I'll ask each team to summarize their response to the whole range of contributions that have been made in the debate. I have already been informed by the liberal individualists on my left that they are going to adopt a cooperative solution, perhaps sensing the sense of the audience, and one of them will speak on behalf of the group. I'm not sure what's going to happen to the group on my right. They have time to decide whether it's one of them
we
or the other.
We have freedom, individual freedom.
These people who like this response, you see, can you believe these people?
Yes, you must believe.
Can you believe their rhetoric? Well, let's see. First of all, any issues of response to facts? Please.
No,
first, before we have the general reply, we'll have any response to questions and facts.
Okay.
Do you have any?
It's only just one point of clarification on a point that was made about, I presume, about my remark about real wages. I didn't say that trade caused a 10 to 20% decline of real wages. I said that the evidence suggests that 10 to 20% at most, and it's very controversial, of the change in the relative distribution of wages, which in some cases has gone along with a general rise and others has not, may have been caused by trade. It's a fundamentally different proposition.
Thank you for that clarification. Any similar clarification?
Well, I just, maybe I'll just give this reference. Laura Tyson, who used to be the President Clinton's chief economic advisor, estimates that between 20 to 25% of the growth in job inequality in the United States has come from the global market, in which, I quote, even a complex job can be done half a world away.
Thank you. Well, I'll now ask Martin Wolf, on behalf of the Financial Times, to summarize his case in 6 minutes.
Oh, right.
If he wishes to take that long. I'm sorry, we agreed 2 minutes for each speaker, so
fine.
6 minutes if you're being collaborative. Is that?
Yes. I think I've heard in this debate two things, one for which I have enormous respect and one for which I don't. The first, and most obvious, is a tremendous feeling of pain. I don't know how many of the people in the room have directly suffered, but they obviously feel very strongly on behalf of those who have. And it seems to me perfectly clear that all economic processes, without exception, have led at some point to some people doing worse than others. it is obvious that the change in the world economy, which has led to a tremendous increase in opportunities, I just don't think it's possible to deny that, means that those who have enjoyed a virtual monopoly of the fruits of industrialization have to live in a situation where they no longer have that. And this creates really quite difficult problems for people who are used to living in certain ways in certain communities. These problems are not new. At every stage in human history, and certainly throughout the whole process of industrial development, gigantic changes have been required in settled and traditional ways of life. As somebody implied, in fact, by a question about Chinese peasants, of course, our societies were all peasant societies a couple of centuries ago. All that deep traditional way of life was swept away by the processes which have led to the world we now live, which everybody apparently now thinks is perfect and has to be defended. But I recognize the pain, and we have a huge problem in the wealthy countries of the world, but we certainly have the resources, in my view, to deal with it, in managing an adjustment to a new world which will come and which we will not be able to stop. Far less respect, however, do I have for a line of argument which seems to me, with all due respect to our opponents, to be very familiar from the debates I had in the 60s as a young student with Marxists on everything, absolutely everything in the world that can possibly be wrong, anything that you can imagine, the environment, labor, the economy, the collapse of our political systems, the policies of the French Central Bank, whatever it may be, are all due to the conspiracy of global capitalists served by their lickspittle toadies, the journalists of the financial press. If you believe that, I know I will not persuade you otherwise, because I've been there, I've tried to, and I'm really quite convinced that you will remain completely convinced of what you believed before you came into the room. But I think that any reasonable person who looks at the events of the last 20 or 30 years, where success has occurred and where it has not, will realize that those sets of ideas are total nonsense. Now, let me then stress the basis of our position is that in the last resort, what drives the world economy is not some vast conspiracy by the wealthy, but the aspirations of perfectly normal people to choose better jobs than worse ones, better ways of life than worse ones, not ones we would choose, because thank God, luckily, we do not have those choices. But if anyone has spent a lot of time in China and compares the conditions in, for instance, Shanghai or southern China with where these people came from, they will realize how vast are the improvements that they enjoy and that even more their children and grandchildren will enjoy. Now, let me now deal with three specific points of all the vast range that have been raised. First, the environment. There seem to me two fundamentally different problems here. The local problem, the problem of what happens in countries themselves, and a global problem. The local problem, it is alleged, is caused by capitalism, by market-led growth. The truth, I would suggest very strongly, is the opposite. If you look at the conditions that really worry people, the dreadful water that people have to drink, which kills them and their children, if you look at the problem of deforestation, which is destroying large parts of the planet, these are clearly the results of poverty, not the results of growth. The biggest local problems that we suffer in the world are the consequences of mass inhuman poverty, which only economic growth will alleviate, and the only safe way of doing that is through a more efficient participation in the world economy. There is a global problem which has been pointed out. Maybe there just aren't enough resources to go round. I don't believe it. We can argue it at length. But one thing is absolutely clear. If it is true that there aren't enough resources to go round, then there is no way on earth that we, in our comfortable countries, will be able to continue to enjoy the fruits of approximately 70 or 80% of world output. And the first thing we will have to do is give it to the rest of the world. And if that is what they want, if our opponents want, then I regard that as a completely logical and reasonable position. We should, instead of whining about what is happening to our societies, be prepared. If that is the position, we can't have growth, we've got to stop, then the logical consequences is to give away the large part of the extraordinary control over resources that we have gained in the success of market development over the last two centuries. Finally, I want to say just one other point. A lot of talk has been given about the orthodoxy that we represent. And the assumption seems to be that this orthodoxy has always been there, that everybody always agreed with it, and somehow or other, some lunatics have stuck by this through thick and thin for decades. Now, I've been concerned with questions of economic development throughout my professional life, which is about 25, 26 years. And I'm proud to be associated not only with the Financial Times, but before that with the World Bank. When I started, the ideas that we have put forward were regarded in much of the world and throughout the developing world as mad. It was obvious, and I spent years working on India, for example, that the way to success was planning, stopping the exploitation of the country by multinationals, stopping capital inflow, indigenization of everything, and they did it. And they did it very successfully. And they discovered after another 20, 30, 40 years, that they'd fallen behind completely. And that's why they changed. The orthodoxy wasn't imposed upon them. The new orthodoxy evolved from painful, dreadful experience, whose result was to keep hundreds of millions of people into utterly unnecessary poverty far longer than was needed.
Each for a more diplomatic.
Yes, until the mid-70s, inequalities between people, regions and countries were declining. And at global level, the rate of growth of inequalities were going down. It's a start from the mid-70s that inequalities between people and within the same countries and then between countries started again. So I want to say to Peter Martin that it's absolutely not true to say that the data shows that the situation at global level has been statistically improved. No, statistics from United Nations proves that the change occurred in the mid-70s when we abandoned the kind of mixed, pluralist type of economy, where the world economy was based on a lot of principles of a mixed economy, pluralistic way of doing, and where kind of a welfare was driving the way we produce wealth. And second point is that precisely starting from the mid-70s, the productivity gains repartition within our countries and the global level start to move more again to financial capital. It was the productivity gains went more and more to capital, and not to labor, and not to common wealth, and not to common infrastructure, and not to common services. And in the last 20 years, we witnessed a strong redistribution of the increase of productivity gains at global level in favor of capital, financial capital. And this explains now that increasing people are becoming poor and increasing richer people are becoming richer. This is because the productivity governance at the global level is more and more in favor to capital. So the problem is now, do we have a possibility to organize a system, a win-win game at global level, where the productivity gains are going to be redistributed in the interest of the 8 billion people who are going to inhabit the planet in the next 20-25 years. And the question is that absolutely is true and is evident that there will be no productivity gain redistribution in the interest of the 8 billion people if we leave the principle competitive rivalry to kill the competitors, to, as many American universities say, that competitiveness becomes the capacity of destruction of the innovation of your competitors. If these principles of winner-losers, and again, Martin Wolf has expressed that the logic is always to have in the history winner-losers, and the problem is to know that in the next 25 years, you will be big amongst the winners, because, by the way, transformation, change, technology will make you winner or will make you losers. And as a matter of fact, the most important titles that of the FT articles are always who is going to win. The majority of their titles is always who is going to win. The struggle intensifies. The war is intensified. So we must now invent a new system through which we can orient the promotion of the productivity gains and its redistribution in terms of building up commonwealth, in terms of infrastructure, transport, water access, etc., etc. And I think that is possible. And one way to go, and I finished, one way to go, it seems, is to disarm the finance power. Financial power must be disarmed. Today, they have the armament. Today, they are the strongest. We must disarm financial power. That's it.
What often strikes me in the discourse of some defenders of the market of globalization is its extremism, its oblivion of the notion of healthy doubt. It's the analogy one can easily draw with the discourse of communists 30 or 40 years ago, the one you ascribe to us, Marxist from the 60s. During the 60s, I was quite young. You cited China more than Marxists even did in the 60s. Markets, according to the defenders of this system, have to be a great model, and so is globalization. And when it doesn't quite work, we hear, give us more time, let us go one more step. Change is always painful. What we've seen was not pure enough. If only the people were better, more pliable, things would have worked out beautifully. Social inequalities? Oh, it's because we don't have enough markets. School or hospital vouchers, enterprise zones, tax breaks, pension funds, competition within the civil service. Like with communism before, every failure in the march towards a pure, radiant, bountiful market society is explained by the timidity of the march, not by its direction. And like with communism before, the critics of the model have to be irrational, in need of re-education. A re-education program or maybe a mental treatment. Aren't we Luddites after all? Don't we just utter total nonsense? Well, it might be that the market is the model that doesn't work well for most people. That markets may be a great wealth-creating machine, but not so great when it comes to building a human, just, decent society for most of us. What will it take us to learn that? How many people living in poverty? How many people sealed out of the exuberance of the market? How many people sealed out of gated communities? How many people behind bars? How many riots? Which proportion of us convinced that democracy is not for them? If the fall of communism and of its related certainties about the nature of mankind have taught us anything, it should not be the need for another totalitarianism, for another tyranny, that of financial markets, but the value of doubt. Let us relearn the value of doubt.
And the last word to Mr. Kess.
Listening to our colleagues, not our opponents, of the Financial Times, I was wondering what separated us in our views of the world, the views of the world which I mentioned at the beginning. I do not in the least believe that they are less concerned than we are with the welfare of people, whether these people be in the north or in the south. I'm quite sure that they are as compassionate as any of us. But what I think separates us is that they confuse the ends and the means. This morning on the Eurostar, while leafing through the documentation which I had accumulated for this debate, I came across a leader which was published in the FT a month ago called Feathers, which deals with the slaughtering of chicken in the United States and the trade war that is threatening between Europe and the US on the export of chicken, a tremendously important issue, as you imagine. And I quote now, "The dilemma is to reconcile genuine public interest with free trade." That is, free trade, which at best is a means, is placed on an equal footing, if not a higher footing, with public interest. And even public interest has to be genuine, because there may be a public that is not genuine. And I think that's terribly typical of the view of the world which our colleagues have and which we do not share. I think we have different sets of priorities. And these priorities are not the caricature which has been given by some of our colleagues. We are no admirers of the Soviet economy. But if we have different sets of priorities, we are open to criticism, to discussion. This is why I hope that this exchange of views is but one step in an ongoing debate, an ongoing public debate. I therefore extend, on behalf of Le Monde Diplomatique, I extend an invitation to our FT colleagues to join us in Paris next autumn to continue the discussion on globalization or any related subject, and I hope that many of you will cross the channel to take part in this new public debate. Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank all six speakers for their vigorous contributions. I'd like to thank the sponsors of the debate, the Financial Times, Le Monde Diplomatique, and Howard Machin and his European Institute for giving us this opportunity. And above all, I'd like to thank you all for participating. Thank you.